the Onyx Pathcast. I am your host, Matthew Dawkins, and I am here today with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
Yup.
Ooh, that's different.
Yo, mixing it up.
Did I change it up this week? I don't know why.
Yeah, see, I became very aware of the repetitive introductions, and so I mixed it up early on, but I'm glad to see you're getting on board as well now, Dixie.
I don't. I will say the exact same thing every time. I like stability. I don't like change.
Well, as we're talking about video games and RPGs in this episode, spoiler, I guess we could start looking at D&D video games and alignments and how that was always fun, and you're clearly lawful neutral, Eddie, but no, we'll... Let's start with anecdotal. Oh, no, before we even start with that, you know, I like to jump all over the place. Let's start with a basic premise for what this podcast is going to be all about. And we had a little bit of a discussion about this before recording, as we often do. And we want to explore that idea that video games and tabletop role-playing games and live-action role-playing games don't necessarily merge. Some people like to think that there's clean divisions, that if you're a World of Warcraft player, you're not really role-playing. Whereas if you're a tabletop gaming, well, you're not wargaming or what have you. And so we want to explore the overlap. We want to talk about some of the games that have inspired us. Sometimes games that you can just pull ideas from wholesale when you're running your own games. Good sources of inspiration, that kind of thing. And I think it may be nice as well to touch upon whether any of us as fan projects has ever adapted a favourite video game into an RPG that we've ran at the table. So, to start, I'd like to ask Dixie, what was your very first video games console?
Technically, the first one I ever owned was a Super Nintendo, but before that we had an Atari at my grandmother's house, so I played a whole lot of Kaboom and Pitfall and stuff when I was very young.
Oh god, Kaboom is evil.
I was really good at it, weirdly enough. I've got pretty good hand-eye coordination. And then we also had an Apple computer when I was growing up because my dad was a programmer. So I played some of the like educational games on that when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, you know, the original Oregon Trail and in school and stuff.
Yes.
And it's like a Math Munchers, something like that, Number Munchers. There were a bunch of like various, you know, educational games. But the first one I always think of clearly is when I was about 10, my mom bought an SNES for us. I was living with just my mom at the time. And she bought, I think, like two games for it, one of which was Donkey Kong Country, which I still play sometimes.
And the music on the underwater level has stuck with you, no doubt.
I actually still have my original console, and I do occasionally plug it in and play it. But when Mom and I got it for Christmas that year, we played that for 11 hours straight. We actually forgot to eat dinner. So that was my first video game, real experience, and my first experience with some kind of video game addiction and having to go, okay, time to turn this off now.
What about you, Eddie? Because, of course, you predate the video game console.
Yes, that's true. I am ancient and decrepit, and therefore...
That was a read.
And to be fair, I have kind of a split relationship. So my mom and dad got divorced when I was very young, and so when at my mom's house, where I primarily lived, my mom got me a Commodore 64. Because she was of the largely correct impression that a personal computer was something that I could learn how to program. Computers might be a thing in the future that I could probably get involved with. And so she saw it as a potential educational tool as well as a gaming machine. And I remember that very fondly. And my dad's house, who did not care about such things, he got an Atari 2600. So I also played a lot of Kaboom, which I got very angry with it. Also, a lot of the Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man, which is terrible, terrible port.
I think ours was like a 7800 or something, or 70.
Yeah, that was a slightly better console. Yeah. 2600 was not great. I mean, I briefly had to play Adventure, which was the first role-playing game-ish on a console, which is also not good. The giant duck / dragon sticks in my mind. But on the 2600, I do the game that I remember playing the most was actually the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, nice.
And it was because my mom knew I liked that book, and she saw that in the store, and so got it for me.
Yeah. I've read so many stories about that. I've never played it, but it's always listed as one of those, like, one of the hardest video games ever, because if you don't do, like...
Still so much better than Myst, you know, because I know, but controversial maybe or not, the idea of the static image games where you just click on an arrow and go from screen to screen and occasionally have to solve a puzzle. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is that, but
yes.
It's just text pretty much and occasional drawings. And I think it's such an immersive game, punishing game.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the reasons why I think I ended up... Well, there's lots of reasons why I ended up being a game designer, but I think that was one of the pieces... for interactive fiction specifically, because since Douglas Adams wrote and programmed the game himself, the way that he uses language in that game, that's a game that cannot be done as a visual game in my mind. You need to have text component because it has very clever puzzles based on wordplay.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an art form. I mean, like one of the most iconic puzzles that stumped me for many, many months was the fact that in your inventory you have no tea, and it's a running gag because like, oh, it's funny because he's looking for tea and so his inventory has no tea, and then later on you get tea, so you have tea and no tea in your inventory at the same time. And if you're not paying close attention, it's like, is that a glitch, is that thing? But eventually you realize because Adams is genuinely a brilliant guy, and so it's like that kind of thing wouldn't have slipped past him. And so you actually have to hold T and no T simultaneously in your hands to bypass a certain puzzle. And that kind of mind-bending wordplay just doesn't map to a game like Myst. So you're right, from a design perspective, they're very, very similar games, but in application implementation, they end up being very, very different creatures.
See, that's actually really interesting to think about, because when you think about tabletop role-playing games, yeah, you can use props, but you pretty much are just using words the whole time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so having a lot of, you know, like I prefer tabletop games that have puzzles to solve and things like that. I like it when the GM can find, you know, clever riddles and weird things to look at. And that's just kind of a weird parallel I never really thought of, is like text adventures, old text adventures are kind of almost the closest video game to a tabletop RPG. Because you're not actively piloting a character, you're saying what you're doing,
or at least right. At least they're very close to very narrative driven tabletop RPGs. As soon as you want the element of chance, you're probably going to be looking more at some of the isometric games, such as the Infinity Engine games like Baldur's Gate and the like, as very obvious examples.
Oh, true. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even thinking about the whole like die rolling chance aspect. I was just thinking about the fact that you're narrating what's happening and getting it narrated at you.
Well, my family's first console was one of the Ataris, and it was probably the same one you had, Dixie, because after all, we are of the same age, I think. And my sister broke that quite early on into my life, so I don't remember playing on it much. I remember bowling on it, but that was about it. She used to jam the cartridges in slot a bit too hard, and so she just bust the console. So my first console was the Nintendo Entertainment System, or Famicom, and I remember my first two games on it were Double Dragon 2 and Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles, because it had been censored, because ninjas were violent. And Michelangelo did not have nunchucks because they were illegal in the UK at the time, so they were censored. He had a stick, a small stick instead, if I remember correctly.
So just get rid of the chain from the graphic.
Yeah, exactly. It was because, if I recall, and admittedly this is going back some way, a child had swung a bike chain whilst imitating Bruce Lee, and it had taken another child's eye out, and so a law was passed immediately after without any debate. You know how these things happen. You've seen the Satanic Panic, after all, with D&D.
Yeah.
But what I remember in particular was I gravitated toward any games, even when I was only 5 or 6 or 7 years old, where there were characters with character, with a bio. If the game was just get from point A to point B and accomplish this thing, my interest in it waned fantastically. And so it always confused me. If I was playing, let's say, Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo, and there were play as my cousins, let's say. I'd play it with them. And they would just pick a random character and we would fight, and that would be enough for them. I was the person looking up, well, what I want to find out more about this Sagat character's backstory and what is E. Honda's blood type. Well, luckily, in Japanese games, they always tell you these things.
That might actually be why I was more attracted to, say, the Donkey Kong franchise than Mario. Like, I love the Mario games, I love the Kirby games. We were definitely a Nintendo family until my stepdad moved in and brought a PlayStation. We had all the Nintendo games, and in the Donkey Kong Country games, there actually is a lot of story and a lot of backstory for all the characters, and a character named Dixie in 2 and 3, which, let's face it, that's the only character named Dixie I've ever gotten to play.
There you go.
I had the first Metal Gear game, or at least the Nintendo port, because the MSX never came out in the UK, as far as I recall. So I had the Nintendo version of Metal Gear, and that was the game that completely blew my mind as a child. I would just play it and play it and play it. That and Punch-Out, but for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Punch-Out because, again, all the characters had distinctive characteristics, even if they were just racial stereotypes and cultural stereotypes. But in the case of Metal Gear, you were, of course, operating on your stealth mission, which was fantastic for a game which was on an 8-bit console, but you also had your cutaways to using your codec and speaking to your various sources of information, who would be telling you about the upcoming boss, what they were about, you know, who they were, where they were from, and why they were doing what they were doing. And you could sort of build these very two-dimensional relationships with the other people on the other end of your codec. And I remember a point where you're approaching one of the sub-bosses rooms, and a guy called Schneider comes through to you on the codec, who's been helping you throughout the entire game, and he says, "I've just found something out about the the person in charge of Outer Heaven. His identity is Arg." and Schneider dies. And I remember being very young at the time and feeling quite bereft, because this guy had been with me from the beginning of the mission. Never mind the fact that if I left the screen and came back into it, I got the exact same conversation with him.
Right.
And that level of detail, that immersion into both story and character, is, I can very much directly link that to how I view role-playing games as well, those sort of defining points for me when I'm building a city or building a world or just an interesting antagonist. It will come through conversation and backstory without being too dense. But okay, so Eddie.
Yes.
We've obviously heard a lot that tabletop RPGs and video game RPGs don't mesh, and we discussed it briefly on another episode, I think.
Yeah.
So when were you first confronted with that? Was that was it a warring fandom, and how did you respond to that? Did you ever take one side or the other? Did you consider yourself a video gamer or a tabletop role player? What were your thoughts when that kind of school of thought came to bear?
I think probably the first time I dealt with it was right around the time where SSI was putting out the Gold Box D&D games. So it's a Pool of Radiance, the original PC D&D style games. I'm blanking all the names right now, but there was a couple of Forgotten Realms ones. There's a couple of Dark Sun ones. And because of the limitations of the systems at the time, and also just the state of design, the initial ones were very dungeon crawly. You roll up six characters, you wander through a maze, you beat up monsters, you go up in levels, you beat up bigger monsters. And that's a large chunk of the game. The Gold Box started to put in flavor and context and characterization. You know, it was kind of very rudimentary at the time, but implementing story. But there was a lot of embracing it within the media at the time. You know, Dragon Magazine, obviously, loved them because it was the TSR house organ magazine. Other game magazines would generally rate them very well with the idea of, look, our hobby is now in a bigger arena. But there was communally a fair bit of backlash because it's not D&D. It's not the way we play D&D. And I've had discussions with people, particularly later in life, much more colloquial discussions, because it's, I've always argued that the D&D being presented in those video games was pretty close to the way D&D as intended, not necessarily the way D&D was being played by the community at large. And those are two divergent points. Even then, it was still more of a meh, that's not for me kind of dismissal rather than an aggressiveness.
Right.
I think, to my mind, it started to get more of an aggressive divide around the time that video games became big moneymakers. The Warcraft franchise, before it became World of Warcraft, Warcraft became really, really big. StarCraft became really, really big. And then there were RPG versions of those games, and people felt like somehow that was an intrusion. You know, like, how dare you take your video game stuff and bring it into RPGs? And that's why I started seeing more of the dichotomy. Of course, that maps with the rise of internet and accessibility, people being able to post their opinions more freely. That's when I started to see not only that these were somehow incompatible concepts, but also the idea that design from either side was going to taint or corrupt the other, which is frankly a ludicrous standpoint for me. But I can understand why perhaps some people felt alienated by it. If you look at this other side and say, you know, that I don't like that thing, and that thing seems to be intruding into my space, I now hate everything associated with that thing. It's certainly a trope we've seen a lot of even today, you know, how right. dare these outside things come inside and ruin my gaming, quote unquote. But from a design standpoint, a lot of how we view computer role-playing games ultimately stems from D&D. So, I mean, it's particularly the early Famicom games like Dragon Warrior, Wizardry, the PC side, all those games very, very, very heavily inspired by original Dungeons and Dragons. So the idea that that stuff coming back around and influencing tabletop role-playing games, it seems almost natural rather than an imposition.
Yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from, although I'm not as familiar with all those early games as you are. Yeah. That's not something that was part of my era, unfortunately. Because by the time I was playing role-playing games, like, video game role-playing games were a really big deal.
Yeah.
So, like, it seemed very, very natural to me. Like, I've never actually dealt much with this antagonism that we're kind of talking about, because it's not something that was in my sphere at the time. Like, it was totally normal to be like, oh, I play Final Fantasy VII, and then I also go play, you know, Vampire the Masquerade. Like, they're different experiences, and they don't intrude on each other.
I think the most modern example of this antagonism is probably Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. That's where I saw the most explicit divide.
Oh, yes.
Using that language. Because a lot of what 4th edition did, and I'm going to say up front, I am a defender of 4th edition. So for people who want to hate me, let's just get that out of the way now.
We hate you.
You can send your hate mail to click, clack, clack, click, bang on Twitter.
That's it. Get my name wrong. I don't mind.
Yeah, I didn't even say it right.
I don't know. Whoever that person is, too, they're going to get a whole bunch of hate mail about D&D. But a lot of the design of 4E uses very explicit video game language. There are slots that you can put equipment into. You have a head slot, a belt slot, an arm slot, a chest slot. I think it was the first time they used spell slots specifically as language. I may be wrong on that. The idea that you can heal kind of organically during the game, all that kind of stuff, definitely derived from specifically MMO style design.
Right.
And since Hasbro was in the process of trying to sell a MMO based on Dungeons & Dragons, there was a lot of argument that 4E was just kind of set up to make things easier for the video game franchises that make more money. And I don't know if that's true or not. It may entirely be part of the initial design. I've certainly been in meetings on other properties where something like that comes up. But I do think it is important to state that people who – I could see an argument being made, and I made the argument at the time, that people who aren't familiar with tabletop role-playing games but who are familiar with video games that have derived from tabletop role-playing games and who have evolved their own language, using that language in tabletop games to attract those people and make the transition easier is a valid design path, even if I don't necessarily agree with it.
And I think we saw a lot of those people this past year at PAX Unplugged, because a lot of folks, it seemed, came to that show just because it was a PAX show. But PAX shows are typically video game based. And so a lot of people were coming in the dealer hall going, I don't even know what a tabletop role-playing game is, but can you explain it to me in, World of Warcraft terms, essentially? And it's like, yes, I can, because I played World of Warcraft for 10 years. So let's talk about this. I don't think that's a bad thing, using some of that language to, entice players.
No, it's frightening in a way that there are people that don't know what tabletop RPGs are, but it's also fantastic. That's a wonderful moment when you're invited to actually tell someone about what a tabletop RPG is, because especially if they're interested, so what do you do for a living? Well, and then you tell them something they really don't care about. But when they ask, so what's a tabletop RPG? And you can start talking about these wonderful games we work on, and you never know, make them want to pick one up and play or check them out further on our website or wherever. I think that's always wonderful. And it's interesting because the big divide that D&D 4 Warcraft analogy, while it certainly existed for me, I remember reading a lot more about it than experiencing it. And I was pretty active at UK conventions and at my own clubs over here. Our division, although it doesn't necessarily play too heavily into our podcast today, it was more between miniatures games and tabletop RPGs. And there's some similarities, because over in the UK, as I'm sure over in the US, Warhammer is massive. And there was always a little bit of snobbishness from role players toward miniatures gamers, so Warhammer gamers, and sometimes the other way around. And I don't know whether it was just the atmosphere people felt whenever they entered a Games Workshop, or whether it was the atmosphere miniatures gamers felt when they entered a role-playing club. But there was... I remember the first time I went into a Games Workshop and feeling utterly disappointed that they weren't selling role-playing games. I thought, this is the kind of place that where they would sell the thing I want. And it was just miniatures, which for me wasn't enough. So I can see why people feel protective and a bit factionalist about their preferences, and thinking, well, you can't steal our stuff, or we can't use their stuff, we should be standing on our own 2 feet. But I think we've also seen a lot of areas where video games have directly influenced design of tabletop RPGs, or and especially in our work. Well, Dixie, can you think of anything that you've seen present in your playing of video games that you've incorporated into your tabletop RPG experiences, whether it's through narrative choice, game design, content? What is it about video games that you've used in your RPGs?
Well, most of my favorite video games involve narrative choice and involve your choices affecting your characters. I'm a big fan of the Mass Effect franchise. I'm a big fan of the Fable franchise. Like, I will still go back and replay those, even though they're never going to release Fable 4. Ever. I really like Skyrim, where you make a lot of character choices, obviously. I mean, I think most people like Skyrim. But Skyrim's one of those that, like, I go back to again and again. And so I think when I play games, I really like being able to adjust my character based on narrative choices and not just based on plugging experience points into a sheet. kind of going like, oh, this thing happened to my character and that affected her, or, you know, oh, this thing happened to the whole party and we're all affected by that differently because we all reacted to it in different ways. That's very much to me like the, you know, story wheel on Mass Effect, where when something happens, you can react to it with emotion or logic or, you know, whatever.
And we kind of have that in a mechanical sense in Chronicles of Darkness with conditions and tilts, largely
breaking
to
points.
Breaking points, and the doors between, you know, defeating someone socially. That's quite an interesting takeaway, whether that was intentional or not by the designers, I don't know. But that's definitely present. Likewise, in other systems, something like Fate. Fate is, of course, quite, is incredibly popular as a role-playing game system. And you can definitely see when you start tagging your characters with aspects of things that they have experienced that help define what they can do now, that is definitely mirrored in video game RPGs. But I'm just going to have to be the devil's advocate here and say that I don't like Skyrim, Mass Effect.
That's fine.
well, that's not true. I like the story of Mass Effect, but I never really got on with the playing of it. And this seems to have been a changing taste of mine as I'm not trying to sound condescending when I say as I've grown up as a gamer, you know, because that clearly makes me more intellectual than you. But...
Well, you are Europeans, therefore you're a better gamer than us.
Well, I think that's demonstrably true. We can handle mature subject matter that Americans can't, apparently.
You also describe yourself as the gentleman gamer, and, you know, my tags on things are just... And a lot of my tags are just gamer girl, so...
Now, I guess my limitations when it comes to games like Oblivion and Skyrim, which I played, and I played at quite some length, is when I come away from them, I always end up feeling a little bit hollow. Like, I guess it translates to me into a form of grinding. And I don't know whether it's because they're so combat heavy, because I never felt that with the Baldur's Gate games. And to a lesser extent, I guess I did feel it with Icewind Dale. But when it came to the Baldur's Gate games and Planescape Torment, which I know you posted about recently, Eddie, and I'd like you to talk about that.
I'll track some more hate mail.
To get more hate flung towards at Click Clack Bang, that poor fool, whoever that is.
It's a poor guy on Twitter.
I'm gonna look that up while y'all are talking.
I definitely hold those Black Isle BioWare games on a very tall pedestal because of strength of story, strength of narrative options, the fact that you can build a party of characters who will interact with you throughout the game and steer you towards submission, sometimes just engage you in random dialogue. Mass Effect has that as well, which is why I feel far more kinship towards Mass Effect than I do something like Skyrim, which is for the most part a solo adventure. Even if you have a hireling, you know, by your side, they're not going to talk to you much.
Right.
I definitely prefer the Mass Effect games and Fallout games, or especially like Fallout 4, in terms of building relationships. But I do like games where I get to make the main character have my personality. What I don't love anymore at this point, and this is my change as a gamer over the years, I don't love games that are so linear that I have to just accept whatever they're dictating the main character says.
So,
like, I don't like it when they force their choices on me.
So I'll take an interesting game then. This is a game I love completely. I would put it in my top three if a top three existed. And that would be BioShock, which is a game with the illusion of choice and the realization of linearity when you get to about the three quarters of the way in point. Have you played BioShock?
I've played Infinite. I didn't play the first one. I played the other ones.
And that's an incredibly linear game. It's arguably a first-person shooter rather than a role-playing game. But how do you feel about that game? Because it's a game with a very strong story, you could argue, but yeah. one where you don't have much character choice.
That's it. I mean, I like the story, but I probably won't replay it. I also have this might get me some pushback. I also have a very big problem with games that make me play as a man.
Yeah,
I don't
I think that's fair.
I don't like it anymore. I think that it's like ever since Fable 2 came out, and one of the first things was, "Are you the brother or the sister?" And I was like, "What? That's a choice I get to make." Ever since that happened, and ever since I realized that that was a thing that they could program in and it wasn't actually that hard. If you look at things like Mass Effect, where they got two very talented voice actors to voice the main character so that you can play
Dude Shep and Fem Shep,
as you know, one of at least two genders. That was awesome to me. And when I realized that games had that capacity and a lot of studios weren't utilizing it, I got very annoyed. Like, I was one of the people that got annoyed at the Assassin's Creed thing. I didn't play Assassin's Creed for a long time for that reason. I started playing the first one and kind of went like, I don't care about this dude. I just don't. I don't care about this dude I'm playing as. I have played I can't think of what it's called, the Victorian set one. That one's really fun, and you get to bounce back and forth between a male and female character.
Oh, so that's the one with the brother and sister?
Yeah.
Characters, yeah.
So at least on that one, I get a little bit of it. But I don't like it when games force me to play as a man anymore. Like, I'm not big on the Grand Theft Auto games anymore, and I used to be really into them, up to at least Vice City. And I have that issue with a lot of single-player RPGs now, where I'm kind of like, why didn't you do this? You know?
Well,
I don't understand.
Feel free to send your hate mail to @DixieStrychnine. And we've got to come up with one for you, Eddie. I guess it's Eddie Destiny, isn't it?
Yeah, Eddie Destiny.
Yeah.
So, or it's just Eddie Fate, but Eddie spelled EDDIE.
Oh, no, you can't do that. That's worse than at all. So, Eddie, let's address the elephant in the room. And that isn't a... I'm not referencing your weight. Yes, Planescape Torment, then, because widely regarded as one of the best video game RPGs to have ever been created and put out into the world, a sleeper hit, a cult classic, and all these other words that describe a game that wasn't immediately popular upon its release, but in retrospect has become so. What are your thoughts on it?
So, For listeners, what Matthew's referring to is that I a while ago posted that I was not a huge fan of the game. I've tried to play it several times and had not gotten very far into it. And this goes into, I think, somewhat what we're talking about here, is that it is, as a designer, I think it's important to differentiate between personal enjoyment and respect for the game. I've certainly come out and told people, yes, Planescape Torment is a fantastic game. If you want to learn about narrative design, it is one of the ones that I would recommend. My issue with it comes from the fact that people position it as the best way to learn how to be a narrative designer, or it is the best game of narrative design. And I just flat out don't think it's true. I think we have learned a lot in the 15 years since the game's come out. Even the lead writer has come out and said that he's learned a ton since working on Planescape Torment. And so it's a beloved franchise. Planescape was, and to be fair, remains one of the franchises that came out for Dungeons & Dragons at the time that was very, very awesome. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I think that that's – you're building off of a franchise. I also think that one of the things that Planescape did well was that – dying as narrative was something that just hadn't really been done before. You know, if you die, you reboot the game, you'll start over, you know, as if the death didn't happen, try it again, or you'll just respawn because that's how these games work. The fact that your character dying and coming back was a part of the story and changed how you interact with the game, and at one point in time it becomes a puzzle, was genuinely innovative. But it goes back to kind of a bit what Matthew was saying, is that all of the amazing story bits require you to go through a whole bunch of very arcane and clunky combat.
Yeah.
And even the update of it, which I did purchase, doesn't really help with that, because Dungeons and Dragons as a core design system, I'm not talking about the tabletop game, was designed for party design. The idea that you were have several people working together, they're all specialized in certain ways, and they all do various different things. And Planescape, you have a single character that you work with, and you get people to add to your party over time, which is a nice conceit. But the game doesn't give you any, it gives you too much choice. There's no clue what's the best way to play this character. And so part of the design is you play the game for a while, realize you made some bad choices, start over again with better choices and play it a little bit further. At some point in time, you realize you made bad choices and you play it, you know, again and again and again. And that's a valid design choice. But if you're holding this up as the pinnacle of story in computer games, it's not, because that's not inherently part of the gameplay. There are games that do that very, very well. There are certain games where you play it to get different choices and the game recognizes that or adapts to it or otherwise rewards you for that second playthrough, as opposed to I have to do the second playthrough to get through the clunky stuff. All that said, some people have posited that it may just be I suck at these games, and that's entirely fair. you know, these this this
you're not playing it right, Eddie.
Right, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, lol, learn to play, noob. And I think that's perfectly valid. But in modern narrative design, and I think even in tabletop role-playing games, there is – the good games have some kind of learning curve, not a learning cliff. It's, you know, here's how you play the game, here's the basics, and then we will either build on the more complex stuff later, or they can be largely ignored until necessary, or whatever. There's some form of, here's the basics, here's how you move up. Tutorials, while the bad tutorials are often derided in design, I think that they're a thing that's necessary and important to get people to engage with games. Planescape just drops you in the middle and says, figure it out. Which, again, valid design choice. It does not age well, I don't think.
Yeah, I like having a little bit of a learning curve on my games, just to kind of, you know, get you up to speed.
I think you raise a perfectly valid point when it comes to, for instance, combat in Planescape is one of those big sticking areas that put an awful lot of people off the first time they played it, because for whatever reason, those other Infinity Engine games handle it better. Whether it's because when you, as you say, you start out with too much choice. If you start angling the nameless one, your protagonist, into being a bit wizardy, so when you assign your attributes, you stick everything in intelligence and wisdom and charisma, let's say, the game does not balance itself out. So you will first exit the mortuary and a gang falls upon you. Someone who's a big fan of the game might say, well, that's fine, because the gang moves about as slowly as you. So you can just click off the screen and leave. You can actually evade enemies in that. But it is not fun game design to repeatedly have to click the screen in order to get away.
And more specifically, the game does not signpost that in any way.
No, it just means, if you don't build yourself up as a combatant at the very start, you have a very hard time of it from the beginning.
Right, and I do want to clarify is that I keep saying valid stories. I'm not saying that to be dismissive. I genuinely believe that, because I can see an argument for the game. At least the first act of the game is about exploration. You wake up with cold amnesia. And so having the mechanics and the interaction with the game being just as opaque as your past is to as the character's past is to himself, but primarily male, it's a valid choice. It's like, okay, I as a player am learning how to play the game and learning how this world works the same way the character does. That's one of the reasons why protagonist amnesia is a very strong trope in video games. But the frustration is that you have to make character choices before any of this stuff happens. You can't adjust or modify your character during gameplay once you learn things. It's just you're stuck with – you have to make bad choices completely blind unless you have played D&D before. And even then, it's not quite D&D as you understand it.
Mm.
So you have to have played D&D before and played Planescape before, or have played this specific game before it can make intelligent thoughtful choices. And that's the part that I rub up against, is because if you make a couple of bad choices, you may not find out until you're 20 hours in.
Well, I would love to shift this to a game that does actually reward you and do interesting things on a second playthrough. Partially because I have no experience with Planescape, and so I have been very quiet for the past little bit here.
No, that's fair.
But actually, because we're talking about RPGs, and because of who we all work for, and because we're talking about video games, I want to bring up Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines.
Because
I, like, games that give you narrative options, check. Games where you have a lot of character options in the beginning, including gender, yay, check. Yep. And also, game that if you play through once as, say, a Ventru, and then you go back and play the game as a Malkavian, completely different game.
Yes.
I know that me and Ian Watson and a few other people have been tuning in to watch our friend Jacob Burgess play it on Twitch recently. He's never played it before. He's playing for the first time. So if we're going to drop any spoilers in here, we should probably not do that or warn him. Because he does listen to this podcast. But
don't listen any further, Jacob.
But yeah, so he's been playing through and watching his reaction to this game that is 14 years old and still holds up is really fantastic. Because it's got a great narrative. The voice acting is fantastic. I actually tuned into a different Bloodline stream last night. 8-Bit Dylan on Twitter and Twitch is playing through also blind for the first time. And it's really fun to watch because it's like watching, like, I played it back in the day. And so it was groundbreaking then, in my opinion. And then even watching it now or playing it now, like, it holds up and it's interesting. It's an interesting game.
I have been watching you watching that via Twitter. Because we're like an incompetent Stasi, aren't we? We're just everyone is just watching everyone else.
The panopticon of gaming.
Yeah, right.
But no, I agree. I started a Let's Play of it long ago when I used to do my YouTube channel. And Bloodlines is a fantastic game, and it's a game that I can quite happily say I've lifted plots from Wholesale to insert in my tabletop RPGs, because after all it is based on one of the tabletop RPGs I love. But yeah, it really does have everything, and it's interesting because, again, it's a game that wasn't a commercial hit on its release, mostly because of the massive number of bugs that everyone knows about, but it's been patched to such exquisiteness now via good friends of ours like Ian Watson, where it still holds up, as you say, it still holds up today. So, out of interest, what clan? What clan is your favorite? No, what clan is Jacob playing as in the game?
Oh God, I'm gonna forget.
It's not Malkavian, because otherwise you would know.
Yeah.
No, I think it's either Ventru or Giovanni, and I've forgotten which one.
I suspect it's Ventru, because I know some of the Camarilla pack. There's all kinds of patches and mods you can get for it now, where you can play the independent clans, Sabbat clans, Bloodlines even. But the Giovanni aren't in the core game, and I believe
Jacob's it's not that then.
So I think he's playing Ventru if he's going around dominating people a lot.
I don't know. I might just be, like I said, I'm bad at remembering what clan he's playing.
And actually, I'm glad you brought up Bloodlines, because it's been several years. I can probably talk about this now. When I was working on the World Artist MMO, that was like the point we had to talk about. I mean, it's like, no matter what game we make, it's going to be compared to Bloodlines. So we need to really understand what makes Bloodlines work and decide if we're going to lean into that or do something different. I can't go into what the decisions were on that front, but I played a lot of it initially as a fan because it was a fun game. But then I played a lot of it specifically as a designer to look at what it does well and what doesn't do well. And one of the things that has always struck me about Bloodlines is it does something. The current buzzword is emergent narrative. And it's one of the reasons why I think Bloodlines feels the most tabletop-y of these kind of video games, is because there are so many things that are kind of held in balance in the game that if you do something, there are repercussions. They may not be obvious, they may not be immediate, but they are there. One of my favorite examples is at work, the mouse I had this weird glitch where occasionally it would register a left click even though I hadn't touched anything. And it was very random, like once every once or twice a day it would happen. So it's like I never really thought about it. It was like one of those things that you kind of is those irritations that you push to the back of your head that you don't, you know, right register until it becomes a problem. And for those of you who haven't played Bloodlines, left click is what you put your weapon on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the nightclub. I'd forgotten that I had my gun equipped, and I accidentally shot somebody in the club.
Oh no!
It was the bartender, actually.
Oh no!
Murdered the bartender. So from the game perspective, I walk in, start talking, have a conversation, blam. So for like 5 minutes, I was on the run from the police. And because I was panicked and trying to escape the police, so because there's a cooldown after a certain point in time, they stop following you.
Right.
So I'm bumping into other characters in the world, and they're trying to start conversations. I'm like, I gotta go, you know? And then afterwards, it was, you know, a few of them remembered, you're kind of rude to me last time. It's like, I was getting chased by the police for a murder I didn't mean to commit. So I was kind of busy. But I'm like ducking into the blood bank, and they're like, no, we're shut down because the police are after you. And it was all that kind of stuff that it felt like the kinds of things you would do if you rolled a one or a botch during a tabletop role-playing game.
Yeah.
So that really struck me as like, okay, that's the kind of thing that really struck. And that's one of the reasons why that experience is why I remember it. Not programmed in the game, but that experience to me is my seminal Bloodlines experience. And it's the kind of thing that you talk about when you're playing a tabletop role-playing game.
Also, I have to issue a correction. Jacob is playing Tremere. I just remembered that he has Thaumaturgy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some of those vampire games, everyone had Thaumaturgy.
You know, we will always criticize the Tremere because what a bunch of bastards they are, unless Neil Raymond Price, our fellow developers around, in which case the Tremere are the most fantastic clan ever. Thank the heavens they got rid of those Salubri. they were a blight on K-Knight society.
Really?
Awful three-eyed cultist, soul-sucking infernalists. Anyway, so I mentioned this earlier, but have either of you ever turned a video game or the plot from a video game or whatever into a tabletop role-playing game that you have run? And if not, that's fine.
My answer is no. Partially because I don't usually run games. I'm almost always a player.
That's interesting. I don't think you've ever told us that.
I have a lot of anxiety about improvising. And I've run like pre-gen adventures for folks. I'm actually trying to practice my storytelling. I'm moving in with some roommates soon, and neither of them have ever played tabletop games, which means they have no expectations, which is great.
Okay.
And I'm hoping to run a campaign just for the two of them, so that they can see what I do, and so that I can actually actively get better at storytelling. I think I have this preconceived notion that you have to have memorized every single mechanic.
No.
Because my past GMs seem to be that way. Also, right. I had a really fantastic storyteller / dungeon master for years named James. I haven't talked to him in years, but he was a great guy. But he would write out these just epic length campaigns that were so full of interesting things that were happening.
Oh my god.
And part of my brain, it's kind of that imposter syndrome thing where you go, if I can't write as good as incredibly famous writer, then I suck.
Right.
And so I think there's part of my brain that's like, well, if I'm not running a campaign that's as engaging and amazing and epic and sweeping as the ones James used to run, I shouldn't even do it. Getting better about that now, but yeah.
I did that for every game I ever ran until a session of Pathfinder where the group decided to not follow my handily placed trail of breadcrumbs. So this was quite a while into my role-playing experience. I had always rehearsed everything so comprehensively that the party could never befuddle me. I always had a note on something. And then in this game of Pathfinder, they went completely off the beaten track. And I never wanted to be the person that said, there's an invisible wall there, go back.
So, right. So, you want to yes and all your players.
Exactly. So I yes anded them and improvised. And I thought, oh, okay, this isn't that tricky. And from that point on, I have never written those essay-length scenarios, which could have been published into a pre-made adventure because they were so damn comprehensive. I've just gone in with a bullet-pointed list of the interesting characters and locations in the area,
yep,
and clues, you know, and that's about it, and let the players find the plot from that. So what about you, Eddie, in terms of converting video games for your table?
I don't think I've directly lifted a video game plot and put it into a role-playing game.
Well, that was an awful
game,
question then, wasn't it?
This is literally the worst, and you're a novel host. No, I was going to say, however, one thing I have done is a long time back, I noodled with an old-school D&D hack called Bloodborne, which became Castle Bloodborne, and it was very explicitly, how do I make Castlevania into a D&D game? And since then I've noodled with it, I tweaked with it, and I have different approaches, different systems, and I've actually talked with Rose Bailey about some ideas, and she's since then put out Miserable Secrets, so I love slash hate her for that, which is basically her Castlevania heartbreaker, and it's fantastic and wonderful, and therefore I secretly envy her. But I was always fascinated because Castlevania struck me as such a rich world that's very Ravenlofty, World of Darkness. And there's definitely a depth of lore there. They've even made a cartoon about it now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it always felt like it would actually make a role-playing game. But also, there's a very specific game style that comes with Castlevania games, to the point where it's actually added its name to an archetype called Metroidvania. And it's something that you don't see often in tabletop role-playing games, that kind of, I'm going to explore a specific space for very long periods of time and end up going mm-hmm. back through them potentially several times with new information and new abilities. Aside from mega dungeons in old school fantasy games, it's not a concept you see a ton of games, tabletop games, explore. So that's less of a, I have run this at the table, and more of a interesting design challenge that I've played with and I keep coming back to. And I've even like, toyed with it briefly. I ran a Pugmire game set in the Castle of Transylvania Hound, which started to touch on some of those, but then the game fell apart, so I never really dug into it. So that's about the closest I got to mapping a video game to a tabletop game.
Well, apparently then I am the only person who does this. but I guess the three that stick out in my mind, the obvious one is I have ran several sessions. I ran a lengthy campaign of this, in fact, of All Flesh Must Be Eaten as Resident Evil, the very first Resident Evil game. Mm-hmm. And I went to the trouble of making the maps make sense. So I remapped the Resident Evil mansion for my players, and you know, different rooms were stickered off so they wouldn't know what was in them. That was great fun. And I converted Metal Gear, at least Metal Gear Solid, into godlike, because when you think about it, the members of Foxhound in Metal Gear are basically just superheroes, military superheroes. You have a psychic, you have a super strong shaman who can command ravens. You have someone who is a sharpshooter, who, you know, hyper sniper in godlike terms, who can never miss. So that was a very easy one to do. And I made a BioShock role-playing game using the New World of Darkness system, so prior to Chronicles of Darkness. In fact, I think I used Vampire the Requiem because I found it very easy to create plasmids, so the powers you use in BioShock, in place of disciplines. Mm-hmm. Instead of blood points, you had Eve, which is the resource, like the mana resource in BioShock. In place of blood potency, you had Adam, which basically controlled the amount of plasmids you could have and how spliced up and inhumane you are. So yeah, you had your humanity, which tracked to how close you were to just becoming a feral splicer. It was a very easy analogy for me, from one to go to the other, to the point that I put together sort of BioShock branded character sheets, all kinds of stationery. I've recorded my own little, and got friends to record, those sort of vox pop things that you find throughout BioShock. So whenever whenever the group would be exploring Fallen Rapture, if they found one, I could play it on my laptop, and they would have an audio clue for what was going on in that area in a usually an awful accent. But that was a wonderful thing to adapt. It's a license that I hope one day does enter the realm of tabletop RPGs.
I was going to say, what you're saying is, hey, you know, BioShock Studios, if you want to license this out, we've already got somebody on it.
In fact, well, I did in my arrogance. Let's say my curiosity. I emailed Irrational Games and 2K Studios. This was many, many years ago. So this was before Bioshock 2 came out. And said, hey, I've done this. And I would love to be able to enter into talks with you to see whether... And this was just me on my own. I wasn't representing a company. To which they just sent me a cease and desist. And I wasn't saying, I'm going to publish this if you don't come back to me. They just sent me a cease and desist. That was it. I thought, well, stick your game then. But, you know, if you change your mind, Irrational or 2K Games, we're right here. So looking at, there'll be people now listening to this podcast who think, wow, that's a really good idea. So build up a groundswell, say the best company to produce this would be Onyx Path. Rich Thomas won't mind. He'd love it. He'd love the idea. We're speaking for him now. Thanks, Rich. We've got your support and your credit card.
We've taken complete control of the company. We're just going off in our own direction. Yeah. We're a pirate crew of RPG design.
Yeah, we're doing the Bioshock RPG. First underwater, then it's in the sky for Bioshock Infinite. Then we're going to do Bioshock in space, but we can't because that's System Shock. So,
hey, you are doing an underwater RPG too. What a coincidence.
This came up the other day. I was speaking to Dixie quite separately. I've realized that the Wraith the Oblivion scenario I'm running at Gen Con in our booth is set on a submarine that goes down, and you're all members of the crew. And I'm not going to spoil it. And I thought, and then I realized that they came from beneath the sea plot I'm running at the booth is, of course, also it's a trawler going down. And I have an aquatic, there's a draw for me to the sea that I've only just realized exists. So I think one day I'm just going to take off all my clothes, run out to sea, and you'll never see me again. I'll finally be home, called to my people.
So, my fishy brothers!
So of our games, and I think I can probably anticipate the answer from you, Eddie, but try and surprise us. Of all of our tabletop games, which do you think would make the best video game? And how would you like to see it as a video game? So let's go.
Okay, so putting Pugmire aside.
Oh. Well, no. Let's look at Pugmire and Monarchies of Mau for a sec. Instead of looking from the Baldur's Gate style, which would be the typical view of an RPG made into a video game, how would you like to see Pugmire and Monarchies of Mau turn into a game?
I think just two. I mean, that actually, I'd be open for any. Obviously, anyone who makes video games wants to pitch to me. I'm happy to.
Especially Irrational 2K games, as we've got them on site.
Yeah, exactly. we'll make your RPG, make my video game. It'd be great. It's totally equivalent. I've had noodled to kind of ideas for a Pugmire video game. One is much more, for lack of a better term, Mass Effect-y in style, in the sense that. You make decisions, and each of the decisions determine if you're a good dog or a bad dog. Because the property has that built in, I think it's a very natural kind of forced choice, like red term, polarized things. And then as you make increasingly complicated decisions, who decides whether you're a good dog or a bad dog? I think there's a lot of potential fun that comes from that kind of design. But the other, I intentionally put in the war between the cats and dogs as a historical event, because I do think that could make a fun a video game, strategy game, even a miniatures game potentially. Because again, it's there's gonna be fun of the big Saint Bernard or Wolf's character, or whatever. Those could be kind of big tank units. And they have smaller, moving units, and the same with cats. They do have big fluffy cats are bigger and stronger, and the tiny little maneuverable cats. It's a very kind of easy way to engage in potentially complicated strategic stuff, because it's this tiger striped cat is going to have an understandable amount of abilities versus a completely black cat. That's probably the stealth guy. So the way we relate to dogs and cats can map well to that style of design. So I think from those are two signs. But I kind of want to decide, because as a video game designer, I have put a lot of thought into that. So I'm naturally going to be a bit, well, of course, Pugmire. That's the thing I own. But aside from that, I do think Scion would have a ton of potential as a video game.
You stole my answer.
Well, you elaborate on that for us then, Dixie.
Okay, yeah,
keep going. Well, no. I mean, I've spoken with Neil, and I know that he's talked about things like God of War as a demigod tier game. Yes. I personally, I've got kind of a different answer. So I know that, you know, probably Scion's great because character progression, you start pre-visitation, then you start getting your powers, become more and more powerful, scenarios right. get harder, etc. So it'd be a really nice, you know, one-player linear game. But also, I'm a big MMO fan. We haven't talked much about MMOs on this episode, but I did mention earlier I played World of Warcraft for, you know, a decade. I'm actually thinking about playing it again at some point when I have time, which might be never. But the new expansion looks really good. I miss it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed raiding. I also played City of Heroes, City of Villains for a long time. I've played Aeon. I played Rift. I've picked up and put down lots of MMOs over the years. I've tried the Final Fantasy ones. I played Lord of the Rings Online. Yeah. So I've played a lot of MMOs. Obviously, I was excited back in the day for the World of Darkness MMO, and I still think that would be a cool game. There's still part of me that's like, oh, I want to see all of it in one place, and I want to be able to pick your characters. I think you could do a Chronicles of Darkness MMO in the same way. And I think that Scion or Trinity would make amazing MMOs. Just because you do have a wide range of character types, you have an expansive world that looks like our world, but it's completely different in both games. With Trinity, you eventually go into space. With Scion, you can eventually go into, you know, God realms and things, the various Terra Incognita. And I think most of our worlds would make really cool multiplayer online games. I mean, even Pugmire and Mao. Like, that'd be a fun MMO, I think. And so I would love to see an MMORPG based on just about any of the worlds that we work on.
You know, honestly, as you mentioned it, it's like, you know, having the idea of the alliance horde divide, if you will, between dogs and cats.
Yeah.
As an MMO could be a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a huge kingdom for cats and there's a huge kingdom for dogs, so you've got your separate places, and you've got places like the forest where they can interact, and, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just, I think it'd be really cool to be wandering through a world that we work on, but actually get to see it visualized. And yeah, I like how expansive, like, World of Warcraft's map is, you know? Like, if you actually look at how big each of the individual places is, it's huge. Like, it's crazy huge. And the actual human world is really big, which is why I think that a lot of the, you know, games set in some version of our world would be really cool. Because, yeah, you could have a Scion game that's set almost entirely in New York, or you could have one that goes between New York and London and Tokyo and just all over the place. So
I could see that working quite similar to the DC Universe Online MMO. I played that for a while when it came out. I remember when I was there, I went to an exclusive party with Marv Wolfman and Jeff Johns and all that when it was announced at New York Comic Con. That was fantastic. Ooh,
cool.
And I don't know how I got in, but I do remember... I do remember how I got in. I just sort of folded myself into the line of people who had bought tickets and no one checked tickets. But what I remember specifically about that, other than Marv Wolfman being a lovely, lovely man, was the sheer amount of free food and drink they had there was so stunning that I just went up to the buffet and I was putting cans and bottles in my big New York Comic Con bag. Because the amount of money I was spending on buying that stuff from stores in New York was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
So I was fueled up for the rest of my my holiday. But anyway, see, part of me wants to say Geist the Sin Eaters. Partly because, as we know, it's on Kickstarter. Hopefully it still is as of time of publication of this podcast. But if not, I'm sure it will be on Backerkit. But I'm also aware Beyond Two Souls has some similarities with Geist the Sin Eaters.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing at all. I think the idea of playing, at the very start of your game in character creation, because it's got to have some kind of character creation.
Right.
You would decide the method of your death. And you decide, you know, who it is you meet upon your death and the kind of geist that gets attached to your Sin Eater. And I love a good mystery game, an investigative one, which can certainly play out in the same style of Bloodlines, where you have a city or several locations where you can interact with other creatures, not all necessarily like you. Again, Chronicles of Darkness lends itself to this very strongly. all leading potentially to the person that caused your death, or settling your hashes from life, that kind of thing. I think that could be good fun, but I'm not going to self-promote where they came from, because although I do feel it would make for a lovely isometric sort of battle game XCOM style, is already XCOM Terror from the Deep, so I'm not terribly imaginative. I think, and one of the other Chronicles of Darkness games that would do wonderfully in the form of a video game, and it speaks to the kind of game I enjoy, would be either Promethean or Demon. And specifically, I think Demon could be a fantastic video game, Demon and Descent, because I can very well see, as you're sort of unlocking more and more of the game, the world around you becomes unlocked visually, because you're starting to interact more with the infrastructure. You're starting to see what, you know, which humans are angels and which humans are demons and which where the cryptids are and all of that. You are becoming more and more awakened to the world around you, and you're able to sabotage it. You're able to or try and re-merge with the God Machine if you so wish. Certainly, as with Demon the Descent, the role-playing game, there would be similarities to games, to movies like Matrix and what's the David Cronenberg film? I love David Cronenberg, and I'm forgetting the name of the damn film that's not Videodrome. No, it's escaped me. It's the one where they're playing a virtual reality video game that may actually be true.
You're mentioning movies. Have either of you played the Saints Row franchise?
Oh, yes.
So Saints Row 4. Okay, so Saints Row 1 and 2 are moderately serious, like Grand Theft Auto gang type games. Like, you're trying to become the top gang in your city.
Right.
Saints Row 3 takes
is not
a turn for the bizarre. You're still trying to do that, but it gets real ridiculous. Saints Row 4 goes completely off the wall in an amazing way. They kind of realized, I think, that what the players liked about the game wasn't that it was a GTA clone, but was that you could do ridiculous stuff. In Saints Row 4, you have become the president at the very beginning. You, the former gang member, have become the president. You've taken over the White House. Everybody is part of your gang still, the Saints. And then aliens attack. And then you spend most of the game in a simulation. But as you start to hack the simulation, as you're walking around the city within the simulation, people start to glitch out. And you start to see all these, you know, things for what they truly are. And it was funny, because as you're describing this demon game, I'm like, oh, I've played that. I've played Saints Row 4.
Damn it, there's no such thing as an original idea, is there? Because I was thinking like Prototype, which is a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where you're hopping around rooftops and absorbing people into your body and, you know, taking their identity, basically.
Oh, yeah. In Saints Row 4, because it's a simulation and because you can hack it, you are slowly acquiring superpowers. Mm. You can run up buildings, you can super jump. It's really fun, actually. I recommend it if you want something that's kind of silly and mindless, but still has missions and things.
Well.
Also, as a quick note of how small this industry is, one of the lead writers on the Saints Row 4 was Jason Blair, who was working with us on another project. So.
Oh, hey. I didn't know that. I will talk about that with him at some point in the future, because I love that game.
Well, there you go. All this really tells me is I've never had an original idea.
As long as it involves water, Matthew, clearly you'll be fine.
Yeah, I need a some kind of pirate game. No, because Sid Meier's done that already, hasn't he?
I think Assassin's Creed did too.
Called Black Flag. Yeah, Sid Meier did it a bit before Ubisoft.
Well, yeah.
Does he still have any involvement in game making? Anyway, that's a random musing. So, as we near the end of this podcast, Eddie, is there anything else you want to talk about on the subject of crossover between video games and tabletop RPGs?
Actually, there is one thing I want to talk about, and we'll conveniently wrap up our wrestling reference.
Hey.
Actually, when I did work on the WWE role-playing game called Know Your Role, this was in 2002, 2003. And one of the conversations we had that time, Tony Lee was the lead designer on that. And so he did most of the time, but like most of these projects, all the writers were kind of in an email list and we all chatted. And one of the things I remember talking about was, because we it was OGL based, we thought, and this is when the OGL printed money functionally. So everything, you know, it's going to make us sell a million copies and everything. Spoiler, it didn't. But we thought that there's a chance of a lot of people who aren't familiar with tabletop role-playing games checking out this project. And one of the things we talked about was we need to put in, if not references, at least concepts that people are familiar with from wrestling video games, because the SmackDown franchise and the WCW franchises were very strong as video games at the time, and still are to a certain degree. They've changed hands a few times, but you know, they were on the same level as sports video games like baseball, Madden for football and the like. And so there's a lot of that kind of overlap. And so we talked a decent bit about what kinds of things people expect when they play a wrestling video game and how can we work on that in a tabletop game. And so that's where some concepts we developed for that game, like Heat, the idea that you do things not because they're the best thing to do in the match, but you play to the crowd, you do things in the theatrical match, and you intentionally lose a move occasionally to build up this counter that you can spend for bigger and more impressive moves, which is comes straight out of wrestling video game design. So the more you dig into how this stuff overlaps, it's hard to not see inspiration coming both directions once you start really looking at it.
This is the one. Well, this is the one wrestling reference that I can actually get behind. My friends, my roommates and I, when I was 18 or 19, played a whole lot of some wrestling game on Xbox. I don't remember which one it was, but that was the only wrestling thing I ever got into. Like, my roommates all watched wrestling, and mm-hmm. I did not. But then we played this game where you could make your own characters, but also play right. with actual, you know, famous wrestling folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So any wrestling reference that I get is from approximately 2004. Because of that.
That's an interesting era to know about.
Yeah, but that was one of the first games I ever played where I could make a character that looked a lot like me, which I thought was really cool, because it's actually, even now in customizable games, a lot of them lack the ability to make your character, for instance, short. For all of our listeners, hello, I am 5'1". Mm-hmm. The wrestling game actually had that. Like, you could make your character smaller. You could give them wider hips or a small frame. I could give her glasses, and, you know, she was wearing, like, leather pants and combat boots, and she walked out to Joan Jett's Bad Reputation, because you could put MP3s on the Xbox.
Yeah.
You could do whatever song you wanted. So, like, it was the first game I ever played where I actually could make an avatar that looked anything like me. Nothing before that had ever had that. And that's part of what attracted me to it, was I think that with a lot of video games, we tend to, you know, identify with the protagonist, especially if you're playing from a first-person perspective, you tend to kind of insert yourself into that character a little bit. Maybe not quite as much as you do in a role-playing game, where you're actually, you know, acting out the character and giving them more personality. But on some level, that's how I feel when I play games. It's like, that character is my avatar in the world. So being able to have my avatar in this world actually resemble me was really cool. I think the only other games I've managed to kind of do that in were City of Heroes and Secret World. I could make people who looked kind of like myself. But in most games, like, there aren't sliders for body type, and there aren't sliders for height. And that's always really bothered me. I'm kind of like, oh, well, it looks like me, like my Fallout character looks kind of like me, but she looks like a 5'8" statuesque version of me. And I'm kind of like, that's not quite right, but okay, it's close enough.
Really,
and I get their limitations, but if a 2004 Xbox game could figure out how to get past those limitations and still have your characters interact with each other and throw each other and stuff, I don't really understand why other games can't do that.
It's really odd. I hadn't, because I've always looked at the creator wrestler side of the WWE games as more like dressing up a doll. And I've never really linked it to role playing, and that's very strange that that disconnect has existed, because I'm a wrestling fan or a role playing fan. But clearly, as those games have evolved, there has been increasing amounts of role playing where your character can interact with other wrestlers backstage before a match and decide to do certain things, and the actions you perform in the match can lead to certain results afterwards, and so you can have an incredibly different career trajectory from the first time you play as opposed to the eighth time you play. And
I made my girl a total heel.
Yeah. You're using the language now. You'll be a carny soon, Dixie. Talking about marks, swerves, and the like.
You just wait. We're going to have a cage match at Gen Con.
Oh.
I'm going to get up on a ladder. Ooh. It's going to be a whole thing.
Yes.
A ladder in a cage.
It's going to be very small, but...
this is Vince Russo level of booking. Now we're getting very deep into the wrestling weeds. So we'll tail off here. But one thing I would like, because I've been incredibly grateful for all the fan engagement we've had with this podcast, the people who are leaving comments on Podbean, on the Onyx Path blog, on the Onyx Path Facebook group. If you're not a member of that, do join up, because a lot of people discuss the podcast, they discuss our books. And I've got to be honest, it's been an incredibly pleasant environment. People seem to be going there just to discuss what they enjoy about the games and give each other advice. So that's been wonderful.
Yeah, we got into a cool philosophy discussion on there once.
Yes, yeah, I remember you seeing that. And... by all means, if you want to discuss, you know, the kinds of games, the kinds of video games you'd love to see Onyx Path pick up or adapt, that, believe me, Rich probably won't take your advice as, let's say, 100% inspiration. Say, my God, he's right, I'm off. I've got the checkbook open. I'm going to speak to Capcom today and repurchase the Street Fighter license. But... I wanted to get the Street Fighter RPG in here somewhere, but I would really like to hear what and see what other people think of video games that would make good role-playing games. So without any further ado, I suppose we should go through our various social medias. So Dixie, how can people find you online?
I am on almost all social media as Dixie Cyanide, so you can follow me on Twitter. You try to friend me on Facebook, but I probably won't accept. I'm on the Onyx platforms that way, etc. Feel free to follow me anywhere I post publicly.
And what about you, Eddie?
You can find me just about every social media website, Eddie Fate at EDDYFATE, or at my website, eddiefate.com.
And you can find me on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. Not Click Clack Bang, that guy's a poser.
I couldn't find one when I looked. I found a bunch of like.
There'll be that, one now.
That phrase with a number at the end or something, but no one who actually had that handle.
Yeah, by the time this podcast goes out, there'll be one. And he'll be trolling, pretending to be me. And the thing is, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy now, because someone's going to think this is really funny. I'm going to do it. And the more I say it, the more likely it is, so I should shut up. I'm the Gentleman Gamer on YouTube. I'm the Gentleman Gamer on the Onyx Path forums. I'm also on Facebook, and you can probably add me. But I would suggest, if you want to interact with all of us, one of the best places to do it is on the Onyx Path blog and in the Onyx Path Facebook group. We really enjoy talking to people who love these games and this podcast. So, as there's nothing more to say, many worlds, one podcast.